Natural gas has been very much in the news recently, so we thought it would be a good idea to devote today's edition of Please Explain to learning more about it. What natural gas is, how it's formed, captured, and turned into a source of energy. And I'm pleased that it has brought Dr. Marco Castaldi, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Engineering at Columbia University, to the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So what is natural about natural gas? Isn't all gas natural?
Not all gas is natural, but this gas is called natural because it's formed two ways. One is through a thermogenic process, like a heating process, when organic material, you know, trees and so on, animals, when they die, and as the earth continues to impart its crust upon it, as they sink further into the crust, it becomes very high pressure and it becomes a high temperature, and it converts that organic material into coal, into oil, and some of it into gas. And so it's this natural, if you will, cooking process that it calls it natural gas. And that's the thermogenic process. There's also this biogenic process where, again, organic material breaks the bacteria breaks down the organic material to produce a gas. And generally that, again, is called natural gas. So it's primarily made up of methane, which is one carbon and four hydrogens. Sometimes there's other constituents in it. But the reason why it's called natural gas is because it's formed from these places in a natural process, if you will, as opposed to a chemical process or a synthetic process.
And like coal and oil, you're saying it's a hydrocarbon mix. Methane, also ethane, propane, butane,
yes,
pentane.
Right.
Do they all mix naturally in nature?
Well, that's right, yeah. So again, in this cooking, say in the thermogenic process, in this cooking process where there's organic matter, you know, decaying and being heated under pressure, it primarily forms methane. Methane is actually a very stable molecule. So it primarily forms methane, but of course, the organic matter is made up of many, many different atoms, many hydrogens, many carbon, and sulfur as well. And those also get, if you will, gasified. And so, like you said, ethane is produced as well. But the general makeup of natural gas is about, anywhere from 80 to 95% methane, and then only maybe 5 or 10% ethane, and then these higher order hydrocarbons, as you mentioned, propane, butane, and so on, would be around 5% or less. And then, of course, because it's a heating process, there are some trace contaminants, if you will, or trace gases like sulfur gases and nitrogen gases.
Isn't methane the shortest and lightest hydrocarbon molecule? Is that important in understanding what we're talking about?
Yeah, actually it is, and that actually gives rise to its stability. And so it is the smallest hydrocarbon because it's one carbon and four hydrogens. And the hydrogen-carbon bond is actually very strong. And so when you have this heating process, and it's basically breaking down the atoms on the organic matter to form in a gas, there's many hydrogens that then can attack or bond to that carbon and form the very stable molecule. And that's different than, say, ethane, which is two carbons and six hydrogens, but you have a carbon-carbon bond in there, and that's a little bit weaker. And so even in that heating process where the organic matter is decaying, some of the ethane that is produced would be converted to methane.
When did natural gas begin to be used as a fuel?
When they begin to be used as a fuel? Well, from my understanding, so I'm an engineer, not a historian, but from what I understand, there's about, 200 or 500 years B.C. when I think it was documented or some writings in China where they were using it for, I guess, as a fuel, if you will, or at least were able to route gas that was found naturally in that was found in deposits to places where they could use it. So I'd say, maybe 200, between 200 and 500 BC.
And would it just have been spewing out of the ground or out of rocks?
Well, that's what happens sometimes, yeah. So if you think about how the gas is formed, it's the biological matter decaying underground, and of course the ground is not a pure solid system. It's got a bunch of fissures and cracks in there, and it's very possible in many places it does leak out. In fact, under the ocean, it's been believed, or at least has been said, in the Bermuda Triangle, there's a big natural gas deposit underneath the sea floor, and eventually it leaks out.
So how would somebody who is exploring for natural gas know where it is? I'm assuming that if they know there's coal in an area or there's oil in an area, then there's likely to be natural gas. But is that always the case?
Not always the case. In fact, I'll give you an example of one that's not. It's called methane hydrates. But to the first part of how you would detect it, it's detected in generally the same way. Like you said, if you could see coal, and that's pretty easy, and you can see oil, and that's pretty easy. So yes, if there's coal and oil, there would be gas there. However, there are areas where gas is, and either the oil is very, very limited and not detected. And what they would do is use seismic tools where they would basically drill a little bit of a bore into the ground and put like what they call a data logger down there. And then they'd drill a bore some miles away and put down a target down there. And they would send a radio signal basically through the rock and observe the changes in the frequency of the radio signal. So it's a seismic type of thing. And that would give them an indication, you know, that the density of the rock is changing from one well bore to the other well bore. And based on that density change, they've got correlations that say, yes, this is likely, you know, either water or coal or gas. But you don't truly know until you actually dig a well and then, you know, produce some of that gas and say, yes, there is gas. So seeing is believing still.
My guest on Please Explain is Dr. Marco Castaldi, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Engineering at Columbia University. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In a few minutes, we'll be taking your calls at 646-778-3729. That's 646-778-3729. Well, recently, WNYC reporters have been covering the unfolding story of natural gas in upstate New York. It seems there is a fair amount of it in the Catskill Mountains area. Since it's usually found in oil fields or in coal beds, does that mean there's likely to be some petroleum or coal deposits in the Catskills?
Well, that's a good question. And this is what I maybe had mentioned before about not all the time when you detect gas is there coal and oil. So this process of the organic material decaying produces gas. And depending on the rate, depending on the temperature and the pressure of the formation, will determine if it just produces gas, if it produces liquids, i.e. oil and gas, or solids, oil and gas. And so from what I gather up in that region where you just spoke about, it is the process that's going on there is it's just producing the methane gas. Now, when that occurs, usually it happens at a slow rate, and the gas that gets produced can, or I shouldn't say can, but many times escapes into the atmosphere, and it, you know, basically percolates up through the rock. Now, there are two ways that gas that is being produced at a slow rate, and instead of percolating through the rock, can get trapped. One is in methane hydrates. If there's an aquifer above where that gas is being produced, and the methane is basically bubbling through the water, and it's very cold. So, for example, in the tundra in Alaska region, then what would happen is an ice cage would form around the methane and trap that gas. And so then you would have a buildup of the gas, and you'd have a natural gas reservoir, and that would be a natural gas hydrate reservoir. Now, the other side of it is in an area like upstate New York, the rock above where that gas is being formed is likely very dense. It might be like a shale or something. And if it's very dense, then as that gas is being formed, it will basically hit up against that rock, and that will be like a cap. And so then it will prevent the gas from escaping.
But if it were escaping and I lit a match, would I have a fire?
Well, that's a good question. So generally, I think the answer would be no, if it was escaping as it was being produced, because there's always a natural diffusion of gas, even within a rock, even within a solid. There is a natural diffusion rate of certain of materials that go through these. So it's a very slow rate. So if that cap wasn't there, and there are places, for example, in water marshes, methane is being produced, and it's being produced at a very slow rate, and it's basically then just escaping through the water and into the atmosphere, but it's very dilute. So if you lit a match, it would not, cause a flame.
So how does natural gas become a fuel? Does it, like petroleum, have to be processed?
Actually, that's a good point. It does have to be processed, but to much less of a degree. Generally, so the natural gas is basically made up of methane, ethane, propane, as we discussed, and then there are these other constituents in them, like sulfur, and which is in hydrogen, which is in the form of hydrogen sulfide, and there's some nitrogen in there, and of course it's underground, so there's some water. So generally, what happens is you'll take the gas and you will just condense out the water, and then you'll go through a process where you'll remove the sulfur, and then you'll go through another process where you will basically filter out any particulates that are in there, some, dust and minerals, and sometimes there's a little bit of mercury that's in there. And then because you want to use the methane gas as a fuel, you don't want it to be diluted. And many times there's some nitrogen in there, which is just an inert. And so they put it through a process that actually kind of refrigerates the gas and removes the nitrogen. And then you finally have what you might consider a cleaned up, more pure natural gas where the energy content is higher because you've taken out the water and the nitrogen primarily, and it's cleaner because you've taken out, say, the sulfur and maybe some other inorganics that might be in there. But it's a lot less processing than fuel than petroleum.
Well, many people in the Catskill area are upset about the idea that the natural gas might be extracted because they're concerned about the environmental impact. What happens when natural gas is being extracted or harvested?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. It depends on how you have to get it. Now, so in some places, what you can do is just drill a well. And, when I say just drill a well, I mean, this is a pretty complicated process. But just drill a well, and then the pressure from the reserve would push the gas up, and you could basically just put a kind of a pipeline on it and start to ship it. In the Catskills, it's underneath the shale, which is a pretty dense rock. So what they have to do is drill into the rock and then basically fracture the rock. And when you fracture the rock, obviously you're creating a lot more pores and a lot more open space where not only the gas will flow, but but other things will flow, like water from the aquifer. So it's a little bit more of an invasive process. Now, it's not much more invasive than if it was, say, trying to extract oil from a system or coal from a system. But so that's the process that occurs. Where they're fracturing the rock, I'm thinking they're fracturing the rock, and that not only allows the gas to flow to the wells that they want, but also now creates more of a movement of, say, the natural aquifer that's underneath there.
But don't they also inject chemicals to move the gas out?
They do. They inject a...
So that would go in the aquifer, wouldn't it?
That would
it?
Go in the aquifer. No, that's correct. That's right. They inject a chemical. The biggest chemical that they inject is something called a proppant, and it's basically a little ceramic particle, and it's very, very tiny. And when they fracture the rock, they want that fissure or fracture to stay open. And so this proppant, which is just like a little ceramic bead, goes into the pore and holds it open. And so that's pretty much fixed. Those chemicals are fixed now in the rock. But then in order to do the drilling, and again, I'm not a mining engineer, I'm a chemical engineer in an environmental department, but they use what they call a drilling mud. And that drilling mud helps the drill bits to go through the rock and so on, and maintains a positive pressure above the drill bit or on the drill bit, so this way when they do hit the reservoir, it doesn't, you know, explode or just, you know, uncontrollably release the gas.
What's been the situation in the Southwest where much of the natural gas has been mined until now? Has it had an impact on the environment that we know of?
I'm not 100% familiar, but I know it has had an impact. There is, right, so it will affect the aquifer. And then, you know, they use this process of fracturing is like a hydrofracturing. They use water to fracture it. And so basically it's a disturbance of the system. Now, I know there have been incidents. In fact, I've read about some incidents in Colorado where the aquifers have basically been muddied up, right, because they've disturbed it and kind of broken some of the rock and put it through there. And that will affect it.
So like so many mining things, there's often a trade-off. You have to decide whether you want to get the money from the thing that you're mining for or whether you want to destroy the environment along the way. And different people have different reactions. Isn't this pretty much the kind of debate we're having now about opening up certain areas to oil drilling?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent it is. I think, you know, in any time you're extracting a resource, I mean, even for that matter, when you're pulling water out of a well for drinking purposes, you are, you know, you're drilling in, you're affecting the natural surroundings, and it needs to be done responsibly. I mean, you're right. So it's the same type of trade-off, I guess, that you mentioned. Drilling for gas is a little bit different because the gas generally flows a little bit more freely. And so only in certain instances, like, say, in the upstate New York and the Western Basin there, do you have to maybe coax it or push it along a little bit. But you're right. Yeah, this is a trade-off that anytime you extract a resource from the ground, even water, you need to think about what the environmental impact is, for sure.
We're taking a little break now, and we'll be back with your calls to Dr. Marco Castaldi, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Engineering at Columbia University. Our number here is 646-778-3729. That's 646-778-3729. Stay with us. And we're back with Please Explain and Dr. Marco Castaldi, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Engineering at Columbia University, inviting your calls at 646-778-3729. Before we get to those calls, I just want to touch on some other things that we kind of glanced along, the whole matter of transporting natural gas, which we do in pipelines. Isn't it difficult to transport because methane is so light?
Well, I wouldn't say it's difficult to transport. You know, it's definitely different than transporting a liquid. A liquid is probably the best thing to transport. It's got the highest density, you know, or if you will, for fuels, the highest energy density. And so you could basically pack in a lot more energy within a certain volume.
And so how do we move the gas along, and then how do we store it?
Well, the way we move it along, it is in pipelines, and you know what you try to do is compress, you know, compress the gas into high pressure, and move it along through the pipelines from, say, the wells or the collection center into temporary storage tanks and storage cylinders. And they'll either store them in actual vessels that they make and put them underground, or they'll store them in, like, empty salt mines or something, you know, empty caverns already, natural caverns that are already local to the area.
In New York, we used to have all of these big tanks around the city that I was told kept natural gas, and it looked like there was a canvas cover that would be at different heights depending on how much gas there was.
Yeah, right. So so what they generally do is they have, if you will, almost, you know, four sides, you know, just kind of the basic cylinder and the floor or the bottom, and then as they would fill it up, yes, that top would then expand or deflate as they brought in the gas.
Should we take some calls? Our number here is 646-778-3729. And Pat from Hackettstown?
Hackettstown.
Hackettstown, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, this is just an observation. I think New Yorkers have already experienced what the doctor is speaking about. About a year ago, maybe 2 years ago now, there was an odor that wafted over Lower Manhattan and Staten Island, et cetera, and they could never, ever find out where the cause was. They thought it was an industrial accident of some sort. But the geologist that I've spoken to and myself think that it was just an eruption of natural gas from the meadowlands. And
because often natural gas comes from swampy areas.
That's right, yeah.
So New York has already experienced what the doctor's speaking about, and just thought I'd bring that up.
Okay. Do you think that that's possible?
Yeah, actually, I think, in fact, I think the caller is correct in the sense that some Columbia University scientists went up on the roofs here to try to analyze and detect it and figure out what it was. And I think it was either from the Meadowlands or it maybe was from the Sound when it was a low tide. But it had to do with the atmospheric conditions that day, where normally that gas would just continually rise and get diluted. But I think the wind conditions and the temperatures basically kept it, you know, low to the ground. And then, yeah, we started to smell it.
A listener writes in, Stephanie writes in, to ask if the methane produced by garbage dumps is the same as the stuff that's found naturally in nature. And could that be used for energy purposes?
Actually, that's a great question. The short answer is yes. It is the same methane that you would find in natural gas.
And when methane from animal manure winds up in the atmosphere, we're told that it's rather destructive.
Well, that's right. Methane is two things. It's first of all, it's a pollutant that it's what a lot of times people lump under volatile organic carbon, a VOC. But it's also a greenhouse gas, and it's a greenhouse gas that, while is much more potent than than carbon dioxide, it's relatively short-lived because it reacts in the atmosphere. And so it's that, you know, combination of being a greenhouse gas as well as reacting in the atmosphere that, renders it destructive.
So another listener wants to know if it's more environmentally friendly overall to use carbon-based fuel or natural gas.
Well, natural gas is a carbon-based fuel.
But we're seeing it being used in some cases in more environmentally friendly buses.
Well, that's right.
And why is that? If it's also just using hydrocarbons?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So the question is, you know, what's the alternative? And the alternatives are the oil and so on and gasoline. So it's more environmentally friendly when you compare it to oil and gasoline, you know, diesel and gasoline, because it generally does not contain any sulfur by the time we use it as a fuel, because that's very easy to separate out. The nitrogen is very easy to separate out. So now those are two pollutants that will not be formed. Or will be formed in very, very low quantities, SOx, which is called SOx, and NOx, which is called NOx, and those are smog-causing pollutants. And in addition, it's a gas, and so it burns very cleanly and very efficiently, so it produces very little, if any, carbon monoxide, CO. And then, of course, as you had mentioned, it's the lightest hydrocarbon with only one carbon. So the amount of carbon dioxide that's produced is the least amount per energy content there, per carbon content.
So along those lines, we put Rebecca. Hi, Rebecca. Are you on the air?
I am. Hi.
Hi.
So my question is this. My husband and I have done a lot of work trying to get our house to be more energy efficient. We recently had the entire thing retro-insulated with holes drawn in the walls and cellulose put in, and we're trying to move over to CFLs, but we're really worried about the winter coming up, and we're dependent on oil in our household. And recently it was suggested to us that we change our oil burner to a gas burner. And my concern is, isn't the price of gas rising as the price of oil rises because of the the global oil crisis, the hysteria, I would imagine people are profiting off of that and gas as well. What is a good option? I mean, we're not a good candidate for solar. So is this a good move for most families in this area?
Why aren't you a good candidate for solar?
Well, we don't have enough south-facing roof space. So for us, it would cost about $13,000 to reduce 30% of our electric bill, and the electric bill is not really the bulk of what we pay out. We're paying about, last year, it was about $950 every 3 weeks for oil.
Professor Castaldi?
Well, in terms of using natural gas as opposed to an oil burner, if you will, generally the efficiencies are about the same. And so, you know, the efficiency of, saying, heating your home and making hot water with an oil-fired burner or a natural gas-fired burner are about the same. But if you think about really in terms of environmental impact, natural gas will produce, as we just spoke about, a lot less emissions and will burn a lot more cleanly. So, for example, one thing that oil has to do, it's a liquid to start, but then it has to be basically vaporized before it can burn. And it's in that vaporization process going from a liquid to a gas before it could really fully burn that it produces a carbon buildup, like a soot or a coke. And it's that soot that then gets in your burner system and that has to be cleaned, and that soot could also be released, obviously, as an emission through your chimney.
Right.
Thank you so much for your call. Is the gas that we use to heat homes the same as the one that comes out of our stoves?
Yes, it is, actually. The pipeline that comes into your home is one pipeline, which is the natural gas that is fed, say, from the gas supply companies, Con Edison, Keyspan, and so on, and then it just gets distributed within your house to the different appliances.
Although they add an odor, don't they, so that we don't accidentally kill ourselves?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so that's actually a very interesting concept there, in that, in producing this natural gas and then, you know, quote-unquote refining it or just, you know, cleaning it up, it becomes clean, and now you cannot smell it or see it. And so they actually have to put back in an odorant. It's called a mercaptan, which is a sulfur-based odorant. And it's put in parts per million, but it's exactly for the reason that you said. So you now smell that this gas is leaking because you would never see it.
We had a call who just hung up, who had a house in the Catskills, and she said that her water had methane in it when they tested it. Is that typical? It's already in the aquifer?
Well, that's possible. So all gases have a certain solubility, can be dissolved into water. And depending on the minerals that are in the water, right, some water is hard and soft, that could also, you know, enhance or depress the adsorption of gases. So, again, because methane is produced naturally as organic matter decays, that's occurring in a general aquifer, you know, whether there's a large methane deposit or not, there is going to be some of that gas in there.
Let's take another call, this one from Cliff in Highland Park, New Jersey. Hi, Cliff. You're on the air.
Hello. I am a member of a group called Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. Based in Damascus, Pennsylvania, which is my wife and I recently bought a house there. It's right on the Delaware River, and right in the heart of Marcellus Shale country. I have been doing a lot of research since this whole thing, became apparent that it was a big steamroller coming towards us. And first of all, it's probably obvious from my tone that I'm scared to death of it, but one of the concepts I've become kind of interested in is EROI, or Energy Return on Investment. So my question is, I see that they talk about as much as 500 trillion cubic feet, of which, you know, supposedly their conservative estimate is 10% recoverable, sort of an industry standard, I guess. But the ability to recover that is tempered by you have to net that, essentially, by the fact that it takes a lot of energy to recover that when you have to do these unconventional drilling techniques. Do you have any sense of what we're talking about net?
I don't have a sense for the exact numbers. I think what you mean is how much energy do they have to put in in order to then get the methane out, and how much energy does that methane have coming out?
That's exactly right.
Right. Okay. I don't know how much energy exactly, but from my understanding is it's not terribly different than the type of energy return on investment, as you had mentioned, of other drilling and, fossil fuel producing techniques. And usually those processes are a net energy piece. And so I don't have the exact number, but I think it's not terribly far from the oil industry, where they've got a lot of information on those numbers, especially with the ethanol debate going on in terms of energy. You could definitely find comparisons to the oil recovery industry.
Thank you for your call. I want to go back to the earlier caller who said that some methane was found in her well water. Is that does that contaminate the water to the point of making it undrinkable?
Well, I need to be careful about what I say, because I'm not extremely well versed in water drinking quality standards. But generally, the amount that's dissolved in water is very, very small. And what it might do is give the water an off taste or a little bit of an odor. Now, a lot of times it's dissolved in the water in the aquifer, which is generally, under pressure sometimes. So that's helping the gas get in there. So sometimes when you actually just take the water and get it to your glass, that change, that instead of being at high pressure now being in the glass at atmospheric pressure, that will eventually come, some of it will eventually come out. So in general, I don't think that there's enough dissolved to bring it to health undrinkable, but it may have an odor or an off taste.
A listener wants a quick explanation on what it has to be done to convert methane into propane for delivery.
Well,
is methane converted into propane?
Yeah, I was going to say generally methane is not converted to propane. What generally happens is when you grab methane or natural gas from a reservoir, and you're going through that cleaning process and that process where you take water out, the propane condenses from there. And then you could take off, if you will, a side stream of propane.
So you separate the propane
exactly
from the rest of the natural gas. And then that gets sold also as a home heating gas, and it fires many stoves.
Is it
as efficient as natural gas?
Again, the efficiency issue really comes into, how do you convert the heat that's generated from the fuels to whatever you're trying to do. So it's probably as efficient, but again, it's now higher hydrocarbons, and the CO2 emissions at the very least would be higher than they would be for methane.
And a reminder that we have a link to our coverage of the situation in the Catskills on our show page at WNYC.org. My great thanks to Dr. Marco Castaldi, Assistant Professor of Earth and Environmental Engineering at Columbia University, for being our guest today on today's Please Explain, talking about natural gas, something that I thought I knew about but really didn't until today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.